Welcome back to Alive at 5. I'm your host, David Leonard, and it's my pleasure to welcome the program here this afternoon, Richard Estep. Richard is the author of a book entitled In Search of the Paranormal. He's the author of several books dealing with the paranormal, and he was kind enough to agree to come on the program here today and talk with us about his favorite pastime, I guess you might describe it, as being a paranormal investigator. Good afternoon, Richard, and thanks for stopping by.
Good afternoon, David. It is my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure to sit down and spend some time visiting with you. Here at the beginning, though, for a listener out there who may not be familiar with you, if you'd be so kind, please tell us a bit about yourself. Who is Richard Estep?
Certainly. Well, as you probably are getting a hint of an accent as I speak, I hail from the United Kingdom, from Great Britain, and I came here to the States in 1999. I've lived in Colorado ever since. But ever since I was a child, I've been fascinated with the paranormal. And long before the current media fascination with it, I've investigated claims of haunted houses, haunted people, haunted objects, and I brought that with me when I relocated to the U.S. When I'm not doing that and crawling around old abandoned buildings, I make my living as a paramedic and clinical chief for an ambulance company and work as a volunteer firefighter also.
Well, I got to tell you right off, Richard, that I've got a lot of respect for anybody who wants to work as an EMT or a paramedic, or for that matter, anyone who's a volunteer firefighter. We have a volunteer fire department here in the community of Yankton, and those guys provide an absolutely invaluable service to the community. So I would want to take just a moment now to thank you for all of that.
Well, thank you very much. And the emergency services profession relies so much on volunteers, folks that just quietly do what they do and for no other reason than to help their fellow man. It's a privilege to be part of that community.
Now, Richard, you mentioned that you've been interested in the paranormal for your pretty much sounds like your whole life. Tell me about how that started, though. Where did this begin when you were a child?
Well, I think I've always had that fascination, and everybody loves a good ghost story, don't they? But my grandparents' house was actually haunted and had a number of really incredible stories associated with it that went back to the Second World War and just around then. So I kind of grew up on those stories and was always in equal measure terrified of being in that house, but kind of fascinated, you know, sleeping with one eye open, waiting for the apparition of the ghostly old lady that was said to have tucked a couple of generations of the family kids into bed late at night. And although I never saw them, it kindled a lifelong love and fascination in the subject.
And so you never had the experience of meeting the old lady yourself?
You know, I did not. And she was most active when my stepfather was a kid himself. And so all the children in the family had the same story about this old lady that would tuck them into bed at night. And it was just taken as routine. You know, it wasn't a big deal to folks in that day and age. But by the time I moved into that house, and I would only go there on weekends occasionally, but I guess she had either moved on or had dissipated or was no longer around, because I never experienced anything supernatural there myself.
You know, I've talked to a number of people who are involved in paranormal investigations over the years on the program, and it almost invariably they all tell me, I shouldn't say they all, but almost all of them have told me that this fascination began for them at a very young age. However it came about, quite often it was because they lived in a haunted house. And so I'm curious, Richard, with you, how did this progress then, this interest, how did this progress into actually becoming an investigator?
Well, firstly, it was kindled by books. I'm a huge bibliophile. I always have been. Books are my biggest vice. If you see my basement, you'd think it was a library. And so before TV, ghost hunting became so common, the only source of getting ghost stories were books. And so I kind of pretty much devoured every book on the subject in the library, and I was fortunate to have the kind of parents and grandparents that would always make sure I had new books on the shelf. They didn't care what the subject matter was as long as I was reading. But by the time I was in my early 20s, I'd really wanted to go a step further and kind of investigate, and I reached out to a local group that was doing it. It was a group called Spectre, like the James Bond villain organization, run by a very colorful character called Andrew Wright, who is one of the most experienced and seasoned ghost hunters in the UK. A great man. And he kind of took me under his wing and taught me the ins and outs of investigation. I got to go out on a few cases with him, and I had a number of experiences that I just could not write off as being, ordinary everyday experiences. There had to be something paranormal going on. There was no other explanation that fit. And so most of what we do, I would say perhaps 90% of the paranormal investigator's time is spent bored. It's that remaining 10% of time, though, that's the payoff that makes it worth it.
You know, I'm curious, when you say that you spend 90% of your time bored and 10% of the time is really fruitful, I would have to think that a lot of what your time is involved in it is simply in research, isn't it? I mean, where do you decide where you're going to go to conduct an investigation?
Well, there are two kind of poles to this. One is that we take help cases as a priority when people contact us because they're scared in their own homes. We make those a priority, particularly when there are children involved, because, you know, everybody has a right to feel secure in their own home. So calls for help are our number one source. But there are also the paranormal investigator. Everyone has a bucket list, a list of places that have such a reputation that they just would love to go visit them before they die. And I just hit two of mine last month when I went to Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Kentucky and Bobby Mackey's Music World. So those kind of trips are more organized. They require a little bit more planning, a little bit more travel, and they're kind of working vacations, if you will.
Well, certainly. And I'm curious now, Richard, when you talk about going out on an investigation, we've all seen the cable television programs that deal with this type of issue. And a lot of those guys or gals, they're using gadgets, I guess, would be the word I would use to describe them. Different meters to measure different things, the air temperature and electromagnetic fields and all that type of stuff. Is that part of how you go about doing your investigation, or what kind of methods do you use?
It is, and there is a great deal of equipment involved, but it's also important to remember that it's so easy to get distracted with the technology. And the sad truth is anybody can go out and spend $100 on an EMF meter and a camera and call themselves a paranormal investigator without having any methodology or having learned the profession, if you will. In fact, there are plenty of people who will tell you it isn't a profession, that it's all pseudoscience. But the field of true paranormal research really began with guys like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir Oliver Lodge, some of those scientists from the 19th century. And the majority of equipment they used was simply a pen or pencil, paper, their own eyeballs, and a sense of scientific integrity, you know, a keen inquiring mind. So those are still the most important tools to use today. It's nice to be able to measure air temperatures, surface temperatures, electromagnetic levels, air ionization, those kind of things. But ultimately, paranormal investigation comes down to deductive reasoning and gathering good history from witnesses.
Well, tell me about that, because obviously I think that's got to be a key component when you talk about gathering the history from witnesses. I mean, isn't that really where quite often these investigations begin?
It is, and if you talk to police officers, their least favorite type of evidence is eyewitness testimony. And if you talk to jurors, juries are very well swayed by eyewitness testimony. But our memory doesn't work the way we think it does. Our recollections of an event do not work the way we think they do. You can put five people in the same room and have them witness the same event and get five, sometimes quite widely varying, accounts of what actually happened. So getting testimony from everybody involved, the people in a house, family members, friends, visitors, is very important. But then we look for the commonalities and we look for what doesn't fit. And other factors of the history involve things like, was the person tired at the time, extremely fatigued, and medication and medical history, you know. As a paramedic, I'm very familiar with the types of medications that can cause hallucinations as a side effect. And through no fault of the person's own, play tricks on their own mind. So we have to look at all the environment itself and the people that are in it before we go anywhere near a paranormal explanation. We have to rule out the normal. And there is so much normal to rule out in that 90%. By the time we get to the possibility that something paranormal happened, we've put in a lot of hours and a lot of research.
I like that phrase you just used, ruling out the normal, because that really, to me, it seems to me that that has to be one of the key first things that you do in any situation you're looking at, Richard, is that you need to take a good hard look at what is happening, what people are telling you is happening, and then try to find if there's any sort of rational explanation for the phenomenon that they're describing. And there's another aspect to this, and let's face it, I don't know if you've run into this in your career, but I've spoken with other investigators that have. People will try to hoax you about this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd love to take credit for that phrase, but I believe I'm paraphrasing Conan Doyle. When you've eliminated the possible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. But there is a lot of possible to rule out, and there are folks that will try and hoax investigators for their own gain. Sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it isn't. There are sometimes people that simply want attention, but other times people do genuinely believe 100% that they are the victim of a haunting or some kind of paranormal activity that's following them around, when the truth is a little more simple and a little more rational. And then there are others that out and out have financial gain. So, you know, the folks that are basically selling ghost tours or are basically have a financial interest in us finding a ghost, I'm always very wary of those kind of cases.
Well, I can certainly understand that. You know, when you talk about how hoaxes aren't necessarily intentional, you know, I can tell you, Richard, that I've experienced a phenomenon called sleep paralysis. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
I am indeed.
Okay. But I experienced that two or three times. It's been a long, long time ago. It was over a 2 or 3 month period in my life, 25 years ago when this happened. But I guarantee you that experience was terrifying enough that I could have thought, I could understand where somebody would think that there was actually another being in the room with them, holding them down and preventing them from moving, and all this other stuff going on. So I could understand where people would misreport what's happening to them with good intentions. But nonetheless, there is a rational explanation for what I was experiencing, and it wasn't ghosts.
Well, sleep paralysis is an excellent example. It's very well documented in the medical literature going back centuries. The thing about sleep paralysis, though, as an explanation, is it's not an explanation for everything. And it's very easy to be overly skeptical and say, you know, you're in bed, you experience something ghostly. It must be sleep paralysis. And indeed, many accounts of paranormal activity occur when the reporting party is either waking up or just dropping off to sleep, as the brain changes gears, if you will. And yeah, it is the most reasonable explanation to write those off as the brain kind of shifting into sleep mode or coming out of it. And as you said, it can be very real and very terrifying indeed. It's something that a lot of ufologists, UFO researchers, also tend to talk about with the abduction phenomenon. You know, is that a great deal of it occurs and can be explained away by sleep paralysis. But once you wade through a great deal of the rational stuff that's out there, there are those fascinating instances that simply cannot be ascribed to medical conditions and the way in which the mind and the nerves like to trick us. And those are the ones I'm most interested in.
I'm visiting this afternoon with Richard Estep. Richard is the author of a book entitled In Search of the Paranormal. Well, you know, you mentioned that early on when you first got involved in paranormal investigations that you encountered some things that you couldn't explain, that and I guess that really probably whetted your appetite for this. But tell me about that, Richard. What was it that you were experiencing that to this day you've not been able to explain?
Well, one case that I think really decided me was a case. It was in an ordinary residence, as so many of the good cases are, by the way. Coming from the UK, you would think we have all those castles, all those truly historic buildings, you know, and you would think that the best haunted houses would be the kind of places that a Scooby-Doo cartoon would be set in. But in reality, whether you're in the US or Europe, you have to look at the ground itself. You have to look at the environment. And so some of the most interesting and impressive paranormal cases occur in everyday places, homes, you know, living rooms, bedrooms, places like that. But one of the cases that I'm thinking of involved a single mom and her children, and their, I want to say it was her brother, had just moved back into the house and had begun experimenting, if you will, with Ouija boards and all kinds of other similar devices and techniques. But we'd sealed off the rooms in the house, and we happened to be sitting outside the kitchen. There was no way anybody could have accessed that kitchen. No way at all. And when somebody went in there to go put on the kettle and make some tea, because, you know, being British, we fuel our all-nighters with caffeinated tea rather than coffee for the most part, and let out a little kind of yelp, and going into the kitchen, the cutlery drawer had been pulled out, and a whole bunch of the cutlery had been removed. Now, the back door was sealed. Nobody could have gotten in through the back door. Nobody could have gotten in through the other door because there were a number of us sitting in front of it the entire time. So how did that happen? And I was unable to come up with any kind of rational explanation for that at all. We'd the keys to the house. Nobody had been able to get in or out. We had cameras covering most of the house anyway. We made a point of taping around door frames, mainly to exclude airflow, you know, drafts and things. And there was no way anyone had come in through the back door. Nobody had gotten in past us. How had this happened? And I don't have a good explanation for you to this day.
Just in terms of what you're describing there, Richard, I mean, that sounds pretty incredible. When you look back on that experience, was that really it for you? I mean, did that really, was that a convincer, I guess?
There comes a point when the paranormal explanation is easier to arrive at than the normal explanation. In other words, you would have to twist logic so much in order to come up with a quote-unquote rational or normal explanation that it becomes ridiculous. So taking that example, if we'd been hoaxed, a member of that family would have kept a set of keys, they would have given them to somebody they knew and trusted, had them sneak into that kitchen absolutely silently, all the while running the risk that we might hear them and come in to investigate. Okay. The problem is the door was taped. We had tape around the door frame. So how were they then able to get in through that door, and the window was similarly secured? How do they get in through that door, silently remove cutlery, which if you're going to do that without making any noise, takes a while, and then exit and secure the tape again behind them? And I was unable, no matter how I twisted logic and played devil's advocate, I was unable to find a satisfactory explanation for that. And I challenge any of your listeners, who I'm sure are very smart folks, I challenge them to come up with a good answer either. I've been thinking about it for 20 years, and I just can't. So the rational explanation just doesn't work in that case.
Did the cutlery ever show up?
Oh, yeah, the cutlery was just removed, and it had been laid out.
Okay. I thought it was completely out of the room. Okay.
No, it had been taken out and had all been laid out, if you will. So.
Okay. Well, yeah. You mentioned that recently I think you described it as being on your bucket list. You took a trip to Kentucky and went to a sanatorium down there. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, the Waverly Hills Sanatorium is very well known to the paranormal interest community. It's thousands of people died of tuberculosis over the course of Waverly Hills' operation. And the place is being very lovingly restored by the owners. Tina Mattingly is leading that charge. She does rent the place out and puts the proceeds towards restoring the sanatorium. But the accounts of paranormal activity that have taken place at Waverly Hills are many and varied and very well documented. So I've always wanted to go there ever since I first saw that on Ghost Hunters, I think it was, and the various other travel shows that investigate those sort of places. And it was a fascinating evening, to be sure.
Well, tell me about that. What did you learn? What did you experience?
So in terms of the volume of phenomena, it actually wasn't all that spectacular at first. My wife was a little shaken by hearing the sound of footsteps following her up one of the staircases, which is fairly common. And we spent a great deal of time with cameras set up, recording evidence, following our usual methodologies, and we actually haven't gone through all of that evidence yet. There's a bunch of it waiting on my hard drive for me to go over. But perhaps the one thing that was most interesting was, you familiar with doppelgangers, Dave?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the term, sure.
Yeah, I'd never really had any belief in that concept myself, but Waverly Hills has a lot of reports of people being seen there when they're actually in other places. So, for example, an investigator might be in a room with you and leave by one door, and then somebody who looks and sounds exactly like them enters through another. You know, or people are seen in that in the facility that are actually off-site at the time. They might be away in town or on a trip, and yet they're seen at Waverly Hills. And the same is also true of their voices being heard. Now, the sanatorium has a death tunnel, a death chute. And what that is a big, deep, steep underground chute where they used to take the bodies of the deceased. And at the bottom of the tunnel is a gate which the bodies would be loaded onto hearses and taken away for burial. And the reason they have this tunnel is that it was bad for the morale of the patients at Waverly Hills. So many people were dying there of tuberculosis. It was bad for morale for the bodies to be constantly taken out past the survivors, you know? So they would do this via a tunnel, give it a little bit more dignity. So we spent some time in that tunnel conducting voice experiments, didn't get any results that we're aware of yet, and then went up to the roof. So I took my team to the roof. And this is a very large structure. It's a multi-story structure. The death tunnel is at one end, and my team and I were at the other end of the tunnel. You tend to speak very quietly in there. It's very hushed, partly because that's good investigation practice anyway. But also there's just kind of an atmosphere there of it would seem almost irreverent, you know, to be loud and boisterous in a place like that where so many sick people had been and so many had died. It has a very church-like atmosphere in that regard. So anyway, we were on the roof. The death tunnel is at the other end of the building, the structure, and it is underground. We headed back to our central command point. And a couple of the investigators said, hey, Richard, you were just down in the tunnel, right? I said, what tunnel? The death tunnel. No, no, we were up on the roof. And Karen, the investigator, looked at me and said, there's no way. We just heard you, specifically you, talking down there. And it just so happens that the folks I tend to investigate with here happen to have American accents, and I don't. So mine is a fairly distinctive voice. It's a hard one to mistake. And they said, no, it was definitely a man's voice. It was your voice, your accent. I heard you not 5 minutes ago talking down in the death tunnel. And I had four witnesses that were with me on the roof. My first thought was, hey, did sound carry? Is that what it was? Was my voice carrying? There is no way it carried hundreds of feet and then below ground. They were convinced that it originated in the middle of the tunnel itself.
Yeah, well, Richard, I got to tell you, from what you're describing there, I certainly can't give you a rational explanation for that experience. I'm curious, as you said you've been doing this for about 20 years, have you developed an opinion on what it is that is causing these things? I mean, is it ghosts? And if so, what are ghosts?
Well, I think that the term ghost is a great umbrella term, and that's you've hit upon a great point there. There is no single explanation that explains all of this stuff. And I think that we are very willing to jump to the conclusion that ghosts are dead people moving around, communicating things. And I think that some may be, but not all of them. Some, and that's a great example, was something imitating me? You know, were we looking at some kind of discarnate entity that was either mocking me or imitating my voice? Or were we looking at some kind of natural recording mechanism where my voice was somehow imprinted on the environment and then was being replayed back? Because there are many instances of ghosts that behave as if they are completely unaware of the people around them. They don't look, they don't interact, they don't speak when spoken to. And sometimes they're walking cut off at the knees or even seemingly levitating in the air, and they're following the path of a floor that was there during their actual lifetime, but now the structure has changed. You know, so I think in some cases we're looking at a natural recording mechanism that we don't yet understand, the equivalent of watching a TV show, if you will. And there's no intelligence, there's no interaction there. And yet in other cases it's possible to get responses, to have conversations, even to touch and be touched by whatever these phenomena are. So I think it's a very broad spectrum.
Have you ever been in a situation during an investigation where you thought you were in danger from some type of entity that you were encountering?
I think, and this is something you'll hear from the vast majority of investigators, we're far more afraid of the living than the dead.
I can understand that.
a good example is a case up in Central City, Colorado, a couple of years ago I was working on. It's an old Western town, very beautiful historic place, and I was investigating this theater. I was in the lobby with another investigator, and all of a sudden, I had my back to the door, the front entrance door, and she turned white, like pale white. And I said, "Robin, what's wrong?" And she, her eyes were wide, you know, she was kind of gaping in that shocked way. And we do not prank each other on investigations, because if you do, any evidence then is kind of questionable, you know. So we have a great sense of humor, but we kind of turn it off while we're investigating and reporting stuff. And she said, "Turn around, there is a cowboy behind you." And I said, "Oh, come on, really? This is not the, this is not appropriate." She said, "Seriously, there's a cowboy behind you." So I turned around, and there is an emaciated old gentleman, maybe 75, 80 years of age, wearing a Stetson and dressed like a gunslinger. He didn't have a gun belt or anything, but he was dressed as a cowboy. And so I'm like, this is it. This is the Holy Grail. Oh, my God. He's right outside the front door. So I opened the front door, and he stared at me. He just gave me this hate-filled glare. And he said, "It's Friday." I said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "You're here." And I said, "Yes, we are." And I'm trying to work up the courage to reach out and see if I can touch this guy, you know? I'm like, am I looking at some period apparition here from the days of the Old West? And then he looked me in the eye and he said, "Are you kids cooking meth in there again?" And it turned out it was just a very colorful local character. And I said, "Look at me, sir. I weigh 250 pounds. Do I look like a meth head to you?" And he said, "That's good, because we know how to get rid of bodies in this town." So I was kind of, after that, I was kind of concerned, especially as it seemed the guy was armed and thought we'd broken into a building he cared a great deal about.
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Richard, in the time we have left, if somebody were to ask you, you know, that you've been doing this for 20 years, if someone were to ask you, "Hey, I've never been involved in this, but I have a huge interest, how should I get started?" What would you tell them?
I would recommend seeking out a reputable group in your area, which means, of course, going to Google. But also look at the style of group that you're investigating. I mean, there are some folks that do this purely for entertainment, and they'll call themselves paranormal investigators. Go to a website, and if it's full of skulls dripping blood and that kind of imagery, you know, they're probably not the most scientifically minded reputable group. They're probably thrill seekers. I mean, I don't mean to put everybody in that same category, but most likely, if that's what they're about, they're more interested in the fantastic elements than actually getting at the truth. Good groups will list references. So places where they've conducted investigations and they have people, just like if they're seeking employment, you know, you'll be able to supply references. The same is true with paranormal research groups. So find a reputable group in your area that fits with your belief system, and see if they have references, and then apply to join, because the field needs good investigators. Always has and it always will.
Richard, it's been a great conversation with you here today. If we have a listener out there that would like to be able to either get a copy of your book or take a look at your website, or perhaps learn more about something we haven't talked about, but I know you want to, and that's the Code Green campaign. How can they go about getting involved in any of that?
So my website is richardestep.net. Links to all of my books are on there, especially the latest, In Search of the Paranormal. But you can see all the books on there. I also keep a blog, and I accept emails. I'd love to hear from readers and folks that have had paranormal experiences they'd like to discuss. So hop on there and shoot me an email. Let's get in touch and talk. The Code Green campaign is a wonderful organization. It is designed to help first responders. So firefighters, police officers, EMTs, paramedics, and especially emergency dispatchers too, who are often forgotten when we list our emergency response personnel, who have mental health issues. Because depression and suicide are running through our ranks at an epidemic level right now. We're losing far too many good people to suicide, and the Code Green campaign is a charitable organization that gets them the help they need.
Richard, I want to take
great work.
I want to take a moment now to thank you for spending some time with us here today. We really appreciated hearing from you.
It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me as your guest.
That's Richard Estep joining me here this afternoon on Alive at 5. His latest book is In Search of the Paranormal. Keep it tuned right here to Yankton's home team, AM 1450 KYNT and Alive at 5. We'll be right back after this.